Welcome to Declaring Independence, a show dedicated to the idea that if two people are thinking exactly alike on everything, one of them probably isn't thinking at all. Here's your host, Ed Brayton.
Good evening and welcome to Declaring Independence. I am your host, Ed Brayton. As always, we are coming to you on Public Reality Radio, WPRR, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We've got a great show for you tonight. We'll be talking to Chase Martin about the Iowa gay marriage ruling and to John Rowe about religion and the Founding Fathers. But first, as always, my producer, Jeremy Behan.
Hi, Ed. How you doing this week?
Good. You're looking a little better.
Yes, I'm feeling much better than I did last week.
Two weeks ago, you were fairly sick. We were joking that you had the swine flu, but that's not what it was, right?
No, it turned out I beat it.
You beat the swine flu?
No, it wasn't the swine flu.
Just a basic not feeling good, and we're glad to have you back. Last week, of course, we weren't on the air. We ran a rerun because I had the enormous privilege of getting to meet Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, that's incredible. How was it?
It was amazing. Really a great opportunity. And I want to thank Julie Powers from Michigan Equality, who was the one that got me the invitation. I was technically put on the list as a journalist, but I wasn't there for that reason. I didn't try to interview people or do any of that. To me, it was just an opportunity to meet a guy that, you know, literally helped change the world.
Did you get to talk to him at all while you were there?
Yeah, I did a little bit. He came in and was incredibly energetic for 77, 78 years old. Came in, and we're only about 30 or 40. It was just a small reception. Came and introduced himself to everybody there. And we just all got to sort of sit around a few tables and sit and ask questions. And there was about 15 students there with a local Episcopal organization there on campus, and they got to ask him questions. And he was very funny, very charming, and really outspoken in support for equality in all ways. And I was very impressed.
I was kind of hoping he would I was going to say end up being the Pope, but I just forgot he's not Catholic.
No, he's supposed to be Anglican, yeah.
I'm retarded.
Couldn't be the Pope, and I don't think they have an equivalent. Although he was at one point, there was a possibility of him being named Archbishop of Canterbury, but he turned it down back in the 80s. I read that somewhere. But just a man of enormous charm and a guy that's really fought tirelessly for justice around the world. And I have a great deal of respect for him and really considered it a real honor. To get the chance to meet him. Well, one funny thing that happened was this was a bunch of college students there, and he was talking about young people and the good things they do around the world, you know, protesting injustice and so forth. And he said, you know, young people like Bono and Bob Geldof. And I got to laugh and thought, you know, these kids are 22, 23 years old. They don't have a clue who Bob Geldof is. They probably know Bono. I mean, U2's still, you know, the biggest band in the world, but they don't have a clue who Bob Geldof is. You know, they were infants at the most when Band-Aid happened.
Young is a relative term.
Yeah, I actually said to one of his aides who was traveling with him, a South African man named Tunzi, and I said that to him toward the end of the thing, and he had this big hearty laugh, and he said, you know, you're right. I'm going to have to tell the bishop to find more recent examples because these kids have no idea who those people are. So, but anyway, it was really a great time, and I'm again, thanks to Julie Powers for getting me an invitation to it because it was really inspiring. So let's get on with our first guest. My first guest is Chase Martin. Chase is the managing editor of the Iowa Independent, part of the Center for Independent Media. Chase, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
A few weeks ago, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that the state had to begin recognizing gay marriages, and predictably the reaction was outrage from the right. What's been going on since then? Is it quieting down at all there?
Sure. Well, the ruling took 3 weeks to go into effect, and actually it took a little over 3 weeks because of budget cuts closing courthouses on Fridays. So it actually took 3 weeks and one extra weekend for marriage licenses to actually start being issued. But so far, there have been no examples of any county recorders or county officials denying marriage licenses to anyone. So despite a lot of agitating around it from social conservative groups after the ruling was issued in that three-week period where we were waiting to see what would actually happen and, you know, if the other shoe was going to drop, nothing seemed to happen to obstruct the gay marriages. So they're still going forward, and as far as we can tell, you know, most of the controversy, you know, at least for now, has subsided as groups either turn their attention towards you know, using it as an election issue in 2010, or, you know, it seems some people are just are moving on. There's even some recognition, it seems, from the Republican legislative leaders in both chambers of our state legislature here. It seems that there's some genuine concern of, you know, being seen in 30 or 40 years as having been on the wrong side of history. You know, that they're trying very hard not to go, you know, even if they are trying to pass a constitutional amendment to re-ban gay marriage, they're doing their best to keep everybody on message and to prevent it from becoming, you know, the vitriolic name-calling match that, you know, it has the potential to become.
That's really interesting because I've been writing this for the last several years as this issue has, you know, become such a huge issue around the country, that 30 or 40 years from now, they're going to be on the losing side of history, period.
Absolutely. And it seems like there's universal recognition of that from the folks who, you know, agree with the ruling and the folks who disagree with the ruling. You know, it seems like they see the demographic numbers on this and see that if they want to stay relevant with people under the age of 30, you know, at the very least, they need to back off this as their main issue. And a lot of conservatives seem to be realizing that they need to do even more than that.
Well, you know, 2 years ago, June of 2007, was the 40th anniversary of the Loving versus Virginia Supreme Court ruling, which is a ruling that struck down state laws against interracial marriage.
Yes.
Now, that was the year I was born, you know, that ruling came down. And at the time, it was as controversial as the, you know, the Goodridge gay marriage ruling was in 2003. I mean, it was a spasm of outrage from conservatives at the time. And, you know, the polls showed huge support for laws against, you know, to ban interracial marriage and so forth. And here we are 40 years later, outside of the KKK, try and find someone, you know, who's
exactly
going to defend that. And so the tide has changed so completely, and it changed really pretty rapidly. And we're seeing the same thing here. I mean, you look at the poll results from 2003 when the Massachusetts, you know, Supreme Court made this an issue with their ruling, and you look at the now 6 years later, the polls have completely swung.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, as far as we can see here in Iowa, that same phenomenon is likely to happen. You know, there are some signs that it's happening already that, you know, after this ruling, you know, Iowans have truly moderated their views somewhat. There was a poll that came out right before this ruling happened that said that, you know, Iowans, a plurality of Iowans actually supported either marriage or some sort of civil, you know, civil marriage or civil unions that wasn't called marriage. And after the ruling, there haven't been any public polls yet, but from the anecdotal private polls that I've seen, it appears at least that it's shifting in the direction of supporting the you know, the court, even if you disagree personally with the ruling. You know, it has been among Democrats almost universally praised, you know, even from some unexpected corners of the Democratic Party. And it really is, you know, for some reason, this ruling does seem like it's here to stay here in Iowa.
The tactic of the anti-gay marriage crowd has been to argue that gay marriage will violate religious liberty, but you know, the churches will be forced to perform them, Christian businesses will be forced to provide services for them, etc. But in this ruling, there was a pretty explicit exemption for churches, isn't there?
Yes, and that is something that I think helped a lot of the sort of high-profile Democrats who had been on record saying they believed marriage was between a man and a woman before this ruling came out. It sort of gave them an out where they could say, well, the court actually explicitly made mention of religious concerns with same-sex marriage and explicitly said that the ruling should not be held to apply to impose anything on any religious institution. You know, this ruling regarded only civil marriage, and to the extent that there exists a distinction between civil marriage and religious marriage, the court wanted to make very clear that religious marriage was being left untouched. So whether or not that was more than just, you know, a few words to try to assuage a big segment of the population that was against this ruling, or whether that will really hold up as a precedent 50 years from now, you know, remains to be seen. But at the very least, the court made very strategic and very explicit efforts to, you know, at least try to pacify the social conservatives who they knew would rally around this decision.
And boy, they did that. My favorite reaction was from Congressman Steve King there in Iowa, who said that he was afraid that after that ruling, Iowa was going to turn into a gay Mecca. Which do people in Iowa realize how crazy Steve King is?
You know, it's at this point, yeah. It's almost as if, Those of us outside the 5th Congressional District, which is just the expansive, you know, almost half of our state, the western half of our state, west of I-35, which is, you know, fairly light in terms of population and generally shrinking in population. We're probably going to lose that district when redistricting comes around. By this point, everybody else who isn't in his district, you know, doesn't even pay attention to news reports about him saying, you know, some new gas or, you know, making some comparison to, you know, terrorists, which is, I believe, why he started using the word Mecca in his characterization of all of this. You know, which is completely irrelevant, but he's the guy who said, you know, terrorists would be dancing in the street when President Obama was elected and all of that. You know, he's got a long history of injecting that kind of vitriol into the political discourse. And at this point, I think most Iowans would rather just not read about it anymore and just let him say it, because for some reason he can't lose.
I am a connoisseur of crazy politicians.
Yeah.
I really like – I mean, my favorite thing in the 80s was to watch B1 Bob Dornan do his special order speeches on C-SPAN. Uh-huh. And James Traficant, who's now in prison. I mean, those guys killed me. I used to spend hours watching those guys rant to an empty legislative chamber. But in today's Congress, Steve King is the craziest person not named Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, those two are the prom king and queen of Wingnutia High School.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
and this notion that, I mean, I just don't, it just doesn't strike me as real likely that Iowa is going to become like a hotbed of gay tourism.
No, you know, and I think whatever hopes we had of that when the decision came out were dashed 2 days later when Vermont and New Hampshire both started talking about legalizing gay marriage.
Right.
I hear they're much nicer this time of year.
Yeah, I'm not picturing Fire Island West. You know,
yeah.
My gay friends are not dying to vacation in Keokuk.
Right.
And I've been there, and I know why.
Yeah.
One of the other great reactions was from the Iowa Family Policy Center, another religious right group there, that said that because of the gay marriage ruling, quote, people will die.
Yes.
Because it would cause young people to, quote, experiment with the homosexual lifestyle.
Right. And you know, this was almost, I mean, it was very over the top in you know, a way that I found, you know, pretty sad. They got a you know, an elderly couple whose son had died of AIDS, you know, 20 years earlier, who was gay and was too ashamed to admit that he had AIDS until he got very sick and so never really got treatment and ended up passing away sometime in the 1980s. And his parents are out now on YouTube saying that this gay marriage ruling will result in death because, you know, more kids will contract AIDS by being gay, I guess is... You know, theory.
I just find that so funny. Do they really think that, you know, some teenager is going to see an announcement of a gay marriage in the paper and go, wow, why haven't I tried this?
Right. You know, let's have unprotected sex because somebody's getting married. You know, it strikes me as really, but I do actually think that they're sincere in their belief in that. And that is maybe, you know, one of the more alarming angles of this story.
I think there
are people out there who sincerely, you know, really, really believe this stuff. They're not talking out of two sides of their mouth. They're not, you know, saying one thing in public and believing one thing because they're too smart to really believe what they say. They really do, you know, honestly believe this, and not just in that, you know, I think it's true kind of way, but in the religious sense. Like, this is at the core of their beliefs, and you will, you know, perhaps never be able to talk these types of people out of it.
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. I think they really do believe it. And no, I don't think you can talk someone like that out of it. It's the old quote, it's not possible to reason someone out of a position they weren't reasoned into.
Exactly.
And you're sort of wasting your time. But they just – it's amazing to me that they think that homosexuality is so powerful.
Yeah.
that it's just, you know, it's like you're going to the dark side of the force, you know.
Right.
It's just it's such a bizarre, you know, way to view things, I think. You mentioned this earlier, some of the religious right groups, they were actually encouraging local officials to refuse to issue marriage licenses to gay couples.
Yes, this was actually this was also the Iowa Family Policy Center, the same organization that sent out that email with the YouTube video in it. That got together with a state legislator, one of the state senators from a rural conservative district, and actually started passing petitions around at churches across the entire state that, you know, people were then getting the petition signed and bringing them to the county recorder's office on the Monday that the gay marriages were supposed to start being allowed, and the petitions were to ask them to commit civil disobedience by not issuing marriage licenses to a gay couple if they showed up asking for one. And the Attorney General's office, our Attorney General is a Democrat. He's been in office for like 20 years, and he came out and, you know, very sternly told every county official in the state that you must follow the law or you violate your oath of office. We covered that quite a bit, and to date, not a single county recorder has gone along with the petition. And, you know, there are some really, really Republican counties in Iowa, because we're talking about very small units of population, because Iowa has 99 counties for so few people. So there are some, you know, county recorders who would face significant pressure trying to get reelected, you know, in very socially conservative counties. And even they are, you know, either too afraid of the Attorney General to say no, or, you know, really do just believe in the rule of law. And when the court tells you to do something, you know, whether or not you agree with the court, you have to do it. Some of them are probably old enough to remember Loving v. Virginia, although Iowa legalized interracial marriage much, much earlier. But
right.
So.
Well, we've got about a minute and a half left. The other issue here, of course, is what's going to happen from this point on. My understanding is that the referendum process to overturn this, to, you know, amend the state constitution in Iowa is very difficult and very unlikely to succeed.
Yes. There are two possible scenarios for that. The first is that the people of Iowa will have a chance to vote on whether to hold a constitutional referendum or a constitutional convention to rewrite the whole constitution in 2010. That's not likely to happen because social conservatives don't actually want it, because Democrats would control that convention and probably rewrite the Constitution in ways that the social conservatives would hate. So they have to wait actually for the state legislature to ratify a resolution calling for a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage two legislatures in a row. And that means it has to be, you know, between one election cycle has to come in between those two votes. So that's at least 4 years away. And then after that, it goes on the ballot for the people to vote on, and it requires a majority vote. The leaders of both chambers of our state legislature have said so long as they are leaders, the gay marriage amendment will not even come up for a vote on the floor of either chamber of the state legislature. So that seems like a pretty impossible idea unless, you know, Republicans retake control of both chambers, which could happen, but just based on the numbers, is not likely to happen for at least two more election cycles at best.
They certainly will use this as an election theme to try to make that happen, but it's going to take quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about it is the Republicans have been using it as an election issue here since 2000, you know, and it worked for them through 2004, and it stopped working in 2006, and it worked even less in 2008. So, you know, regardless of this ruling, I think public opinion really has changed.
Well, that's good news. Chase, seriously, thank you very much for being on, and we'll certainly keep an eye on this and hope that equality continues to reign there.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Chase. This next segment is one that we introduced a couple weeks ago, and no, we still don't have any theme music for it. It's the PH Factor, the PH standing for political hypocrisy. And this week's PH Factor is for President Barack Obama and for those who continually make excuses for him after violating numerous campaign promises. Over the last few months, I've had Daphne Evietar on the show three times, and each time we've discussed some of the very important court cases in which the Obama administration has continued to take the same unconscionable legal positions taken by the Bush administration. Most of these cases involve the state secrets privilege being invoked in order to have court challenges to actions taken by the Bush administration dismissed. This week we learned of another one, this time in a British court case involving Binyam Mohamed, a man who was captured by the CIA and taken as part of the Extraordinary Rendition Program to Pakistan and Morocco, where he was tortured in ways you can't even imagine. Forget waterboarding, folks. We're talking razor blades to the genitals here. After several years of torture and abuse, he was released by our government in February because they finally figured out that the guy was innocent. He hadn't done anything and didn't have any information for us. He's got two lawsuits going, one in this country against Jeppesen Data Plan, which is a Boeing subsidiary that provided the plane that took him to Morocco and Pakistan to be tortured, and one in England against the British government for their role in all of this. And in that case, the British High Court handed down a ruling in his favor, but the ruling had seven paragraphs redacted, blanked out, because our government threatened to withhold future intelligence from our British allies if they printed them. Those paragraphs come from secret memos that describe the torture and abuse that Mohamed had to endure at the hands of American, Pakistani, and Moroccan intelligence agents. After Obama was elected, Mohammed's attorneys hoped that this would change those threats and asked the British High Court to speak to the new administration and see if they would now allow those paragraphs to be included in the ruling when it was publicly released so everyone would know what this man went through. But the Obama administration just last week or the week before sent a letter to the court saying that nothing had changed, that they are as opposed to the release of that information as the Bush administration was, and reiterating that if the ruling does not redact those paragraphs, they will have to stop sharing intelligence information with the British in order to protect our state secrets. In particular, Obama argues that they must be redacted in order to protect the identity of the other countries that were involved. But this is an absurd argument. We already know what other countries were involved here, Pakistan and Morocco. We know that because it's right there in the complaint that Mohammed filed in the Jeppesen Data Plan case. It's been widely reported all over the world. There simply is no secret being let out here. This hasn't been a secret for a long time. But the Obama administration has done the same thing in the Jeppesen lawsuit, only they've gone even further in American courts than they could have gone in the British courts. They've argued, as the Bush administration did, that no court in this country can even hear a case if the president says that the case involves state secrets. It isn't just that they want classified information protected so it isn't made public. We already have multiple procedures in place to handle classified evidence in court. The evidence can be heard in camera, meaning it's heard in the judge's chambers and under seal. Or it can be heard ex parte, which means the evidence isn't even shown to the attorneys for the other side because it's so sensitive. But the Bush and Obama administrations have gone even further, arguing that the moment the president invokes the state secrets privilege, any court has to immediately dismiss the case, that they have no jurisdiction to hear any case once the president says they can't hear it. This is the same argument they're making in the two lawsuits involving warrantless wiretapping, by the way. Folks, it's no exaggeration to say that if Obama succeeds with this argument, our entire constitutional system of checks and balances is gone. History. Kiss it goodbye. We fought a revolution to do away with a monarch that had unbridled power, and the whole point of the Constitution was to prevent that from happening again. If the president has the authority to wiretap anyone they want, including American citizens, or to kidnap people and torture them at will, and then have the authority to tell the courts that they have to dismiss any legal challenge to those actions, then we will have transformed from a republic to a dictatorship. This is not an exaggeration, folks. This is reality. And this is exactly the kind of lawless authority that Obama railed against as a candidate and promised to change. He has not lived up to those promises. But even more irritating than that is the reaction of so many of his supporters. I've been talking about these things on this show and on my website for months now, and I've discussed it with people on an almost daily basis, and I am appalled at how many people I've encountered who are willing to excuse it away now that it's Obama doing it rather than Bush. Many Obama supporters have drank the Kool-Aid on this every bit as deeply as Bush supporters did for the last 8 years. I've heard one excuse after another. The most common excuse I've heard goes something like this. Well, you know, Bush screwed things up so badly that it's going to take years for Obama to fix it all. You're judging him after only 4 months in office, but these things take time to change. Sorry, but this is nonsense. The government's legal position in these cases is pretty much the only issue over which the president has total control. This requires no legislation passed by Congress, no political compromises, no building of alliances. He can change those positions by executive fiat, just as Bush imposed them himself by executive fiat. And Obama knows this because he changed the government's position in several other court cases immediately upon taking office. In the EPA versus California case, he ordered the EPA to withdraw its opposition to allowing California to set stricter emission standards for automobiles and mileage standards than the federal government does. He did this on his very first day in office. In the military tribunals at Gitmo, he ordered the prosecutors to suspend those tribunals immediately so that the new administration could have time to evaluate the evidence and decide how to proceed. Again, he did this on his very first day in office. There is nothing stopping him from doing the same thing in these cases involving torture and warrantless wiretapping. He's not doing it because he doesn't want to and he doesn't intend to, in complete contradiction to what he promised during the campaign. The other excuse I've heard is that maybe there's a good reason for him to do this that we just don't know about. Just the other day, someone told me that they have faith that Obama wouldn't do this without a good reason. Well, that isn't just nonsense. It's incredibly dangerous nonsense. There is no good reason. There couldn't possibly be one for claiming total, unchecked authority to violate the Constitution, ever, for any president, no matter what political party they're from. I simply don't have faith in any man with unlimited authority under any circumstances. Look, there are two groups that I simply don't want to hear from on this. A, those who supported Bush when he made those same arguments in court, but now have suddenly discovered that the state secrets privilege is dangerous and corrosive to constitutional rule. And B, those who hammered Bush for using the state secrets privilege to give himself immunity from judicial scrutiny, but now suddenly want to give Obama the benefit of the doubt for doing the exact same thing. Both of these groups are engaging in pure political hypocrisy. If you were okay with Bush claiming total immunity from court challenges to his authority, then you've given up the right to complain when Obama claims the same authority. And if you spent the last 8 years complaining about Bush and his naked attempts to remove all limits on his power, then for crying out loud, be consistent. If it was wrong when Bush did it, and it was, then it's wrong when Obama does it too. If you're in one of those two groups, we're going to put your pH factor at a perfect 10. You're being hypocritical and ridiculous, and you need to stop. My next guest is John Rowe. John is one of my co-bloggers at PositiveLiberty.com. He is an attorney and a college professor and one of my favorite people in the world because we share a love for three things: constitutional law, liberty, and music. John, welcome to Declaring Independence.
Great to be with you, Ed.
I should mention this right up front, the love of music. You have one of the most unusual resumes I think I've ever seen. Of course, you have to have a bachelor's degree to go to law school.
Yeah.
But your bachelor's degree is from the Berklee School of Music.
Yeah.
In guitar, right?
Yeah, and James Taylor was my graduation speaker, and
that's better than President Obama, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I had a great time there. My parents were kind of afraid that I was going to pursue a career in music, which I didn't, but I think they knew that as long as I got a bachelor's degree, I could go on to graduate school and do other things.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's very many law school grads whose bachelor's degree was in music.
Yeah, not many.
That's a pretty unusual path to take. But Berklee School is, you know, certainly among the two or three finest music schools in the country.
It's one of the only schools where you can get a major in rock guitar.
Yeah, and which is what you got. So,
yeah.
Anyway, well, let's get on to some of the things you and I have spent a great deal of time over the last few years researching and writing on the subject of the religious views of the founding fathers of this country. I first became interested in that subject mostly to counter the arguments made by the religious right about America being a Christian nation. Is that sort of how you got involved as well?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Give us a sort of sense of when you got involved with it, when you started getting interested in it, and what it was that prompted it.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I'd go into these debate forums, and I would debate, you know, hot-button cultural issues. And I kept on noticing one argument coming up. The founders intended this to be a Christian nation, founded America on the Bible, therefore we could quote the Bible to sort of settle the issue. So gay rights, the Bible's against homosexuality, America's a Christian nation, issue settled. And that sort of piqued my interest because I was taught in graduate school that the founding fathers were a bunch of deists and intended America to be a secular nation. And so I figured, well, maybe I should get to the bottom of this. And I found a very interesting story because I found that neither side really told the truth completely, that America wasn't quite founded to be a militant secular nation, not quite founded to be a biblical Christian nation, and the founders weren't quite strict deists, neither were they quite orthodox or biblical Christians.
Yeah, I think I had very much the same experience. When I first started researching this subject, I thought that all of the mis and falsehoods in this thing were all sort of on one side,
yeah,
on the Christian nation side. And I've discovered that my side of the dispute, or sort of where I sort of put myself anyway, the pro-separation side,
yeah,
has a few myths that are popular as well. I don't think there's as many myths on that side, and there's many sort of outright lies. But there are some real misconceptions, I think.
Absolutely.
That have become very popular, and one of them you just mentioned. I mean, sort of on one side you have those who claim that the founding fathers were all or nearly all Christians who wanted America to be an officially Christian nation. And on the other side you have those who claim that the founding fathers were mostly deists. But as we've both concluded, sort of both sides are wrong. Explain why.
Well, for the sake of the listeners who may not have studied the founding record as deeply as we have, a deist is someone who believes in God, categorically believes in any written revelation, and believes that this God is a distant clockmaker God, one who sort of winds up the universe like a watchmaker winds up a watch and just sort of lets it go and doesn't intervene.
Right. Let me fix that. Categorically disbelieves in claims of revelation.
Oh, I'm sorry if I didn't say that correctly. Yeah. Yeah, someone who disbelieves, a deist disbelieves in revelation, and also believes that God is an absentee landlord sort of God who does not intervene in the affairs of man, and men like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, even by the religious right, are held up as sort of the quintessential deists. Like, we all agree that, you know, those two founders were deists, when in reality, those two founders, like all the other key or principal founders, believed in an active personal God, one who intervenes in the affairs of man. So they were theists, not deists. And as far as my studies have shown, the only real deists, the non-Christian deists, if you want to put it that way, were Thomas Paine, Elihu Palmer, and Ethan Allen. Certainly they were important figures from the founding era. They were founding fathers, but they were not key founding fathers like the first four presidents and Ben Franklin.
Right. Let's narrow that down, because by key founders, we're talking about the, sort of the big five. Washington,
yes.
Adams, Jefferson, Madison, first four presidents of the country, and Ben Franklin.
Yeah.
And we could certainly look at others too. I mean, Alexander Hamilton probably belongs in that group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly even though he was never president, like as Ben Franklin was never president, he was enormously influential.
Yeah, one of the writers of the Federalist Papers, and he wrote
sure.
most of them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we could put John Jay in there. We could put Samuel Adams in there. Mm-hmm. You know, there are others that certainly were a big part of this. But we're talking about this sort of key group of five founders.
Yeah.
The most influential and most important among them.
Yeah, well, three of them, you know, Jefferson, John Adams, and Franklin, were the principal writers of the Declaration of Independence, with Thomas Jefferson being the author.
Right.
Then four of them were the first four presidents, Jefferson, John Adams, or excuse me, I should do it in order, Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. And then, you know, I probably would add Alexander Hamilton in as a key founder, and, you know, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson wrote almost all of the Federalist Papers, with John Jay just writing.
No, Madison, not Jefferson.
Excuse me, Madison.
Yeah. But it's, I think there are sort of two main problems of what happens when people look at the religious views of these men.
Yeah.
The first is that I think we almost instinctively want to read our own beliefs into theirs.
Yeah.
Christians want to identify them with their own beliefs, so do non-believers. The other problem is that I think we just tend to oversimplify them and try to shoehorn them into simple categories of either a Christian or a deist, that they don't sort of easily fit into it. And that takes me to the question of the phrase that you and I have both used repeatedly that was originated with Greg Frazier, which is the term theistic rationalist, as a description of the religious views of these men. Explain what theistic rationalist is and why that's really the best sort of description we've come up with.
Okay, well, in this culture war battle, we've already defined what a deist is, and we already understand that the key founding fathers were not deists because they believed in an active personal God. There's also the term Christian. And in some kind of broad sense, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and the other key founders could be termed Christians because they probably thought of themselves as Christians. But when you listen to the Christian Nation or Christian America proponents talk about what is a Christian, they don't have that really loose, broad, nominal definition of Christian. We're not dealing with the sort of the Barack Obama and Phil Donahue could qualify as Christians because they consider themselves Christians definition. We're dealing with people who believe the Bible is the infallible word of God and believe in orthodox doctrines like the Trinity. And the key founders explicitly rejected these things, or with people like Washington and Madison, even though there aren't as many smoking gun quotations, there's really no evidence that they were orthodox Trinitarian or so-called biblical Christians. So they were men who believed in an active personal God, yet they were also men of reason, men of the Enlightenment, men who looked to man's reason to determine the ultimate nature of reality, more so than they looked to the Bible. So we come up with a third term, theistic rationalism, which is sort of a hybrid, a middle ground in between Christianity and deism, with rationalism as the predominant element.
And that phrase was originated by a man named Greg Frazier, Dr. Greg Frazier,
yeah.
Who is a historian and a Christian himself at, I think, Messiah College?
It's actually the Master's College.
Master's College, yeah.
The president is John MacArthur, who's one of the premier sort of evangelical Christians. And he, you know, Dr. Frazier's a hardcore fundamentalist. And it's sort of helpful to understand that because, you know, most of the people who are so loudly arguing that all the founding fathers were Christians except for a couple and that America was founded to be a Christian nation are themselves evangelicals and fundamentalists who have a very narrow understanding of what it means to be a Christian or what are Christian principles. And Dr. Fraser is sort of saying to them, well, look, if we're going to define Christianity the way we're going to define Christianity, the Founding Fathers were not Christians, and America was not founded to be a Christian nation.
Yeah, it seems to me that he has real sort of intellectual integrity here, that he's looking at him saying, listen, you're not being consistent in the way you define these terms. This, I've always said this. If you took Thomas Jefferson, those who claim that Thomas Jefferson was a Christian, if you took Thomas Jefferson and put him into Pat Robertson's office and said, Pat, let me tell you what I believe, you know, and of course, here's what we know of, you know, from Jefferson, who wrote more on this subject than any of the other that we're talking about. He wrote volumes in letters about his views on this. And, you know, his views are basically this. He thought that the Trinity was absolute nonsense, metaphysical insanity, he called it. He believed that that Jesus was not only not the Son of God, but that Jesus never claimed to be the Son of God.
Yeah.
That was a lie foisted on him by his own followers. The gospel writers, who he called ignorant and unlettered men, and liars, dupes, and imposters. St. Paul, he absolutely savaged. So that pretty much, you know, the New Testament's gone. You know, all four Gospels and all of Paul's epistles are gone to him.
Well, I would say that parts of the Gospels.
Yeah, parts of the Gospels, because he didn't think
that
there were some.
The moral teachings of Jesus were there.
Right.
But not the claims that Jesus was God. That was all edited out with Jefferson's razor.
Right. And then we have the Old Testament God, which he called cruel, capricious, vindictive, and unjust. Completely rejected that conception of God found in the Old Testament. So if he went into Pat Robertson and said, Pat, this is what I believe, Pat Robertson would say, get the heck out of my office.
Yeah.
you know, you crazy infidel.
Yeah.
So there's clearly some you know, equivocation going on here.
Well, and the Orthodox back then of the day, they kind of smelled Thomas Jefferson out, and they understood that he probably was not a Christian. So they just called him a deist or an infidel, and Jefferson was not a strict deist or an atheist. He probably was an infidel according to their standards, but he did believe in an active personal God. He considered himself a Unitarian Christian. He never got to clarify publicly because it wasn't really safe to come out of the closet back then. I do get the argument from a lot of people that Thomas Jefferson was an outlier, and maybe in some respects he was, but on religion, I don't see his religious beliefs differing in principle that much from the other key founding fathers, like, for instance, John Adams. If you look at their correspondence, and I would recommend to everyone to buy the Buster Capon edition of the Jefferson Adams correspondence and go to the year 1813, because that's when they wrote the most about religion, you see that they're virtually agreed on the basics.
Yeah, that, to me, is one of the great ironies of American history, is that you know, the election of 1800 between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was maybe the most bitter we've ever had.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really, really vicious. And Adams' followers in particular absolutely savaged Jefferson as an infidel and an atheist. And the irony was that you found – in fact, to go back a second, I mean, it was very vicious, and the two of them couldn't stand each other by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Adams famously left Washington, D.C. by carriage and went back to Massachusetts, wouldn't even stay there for the inauguration. There was so much bitterness between them. And then after Jefferson left office in 1809, they started corresponding back and forth. And they became very, very good friends. And they started talking about all of these issues. They sent you know letter after letter back and forth. And in fact, what we found out from those letters is they agreed on religion almost completely.
Yeah.
I think that Adams was sort of a bit more friendly toward the biblical record than Jefferson was.
Adams in principle – like Jefferson, believed the Bible was partially inspired. He believed it was a fallible book. He believed that man's reason determined what was legitimate revelation. Jefferson actually made a Bible where he cut out most of Revelation, which he did not believe, and he cut out most of the Bible. Adams said to Jefferson that if he wished he had the time and the interest to making his own Adams Bible, but he never did. But from what I can glean from Adams' personal beliefs, if Adams made a John Adams Bible, it would be thicker than the Thomas Jefferson Bible. Adams probably believed in more of Revelation than Jefferson did, but both in principle believed that the Bible was fallible and that man's reason determined what was legitimate revelation.
Right, and that is really a key point. That's where the term rationalist comes from, is that they believe that any claim of revelation first had to pass the test of reason.
Yes.
And that, in fact, Adams, you've quoted a letter from Adams where he said, basically, listen, the Ten Commandments themselves – just don't sound reasonable to me, some of them, you know.
Yeah, and, well, Adams at the very least doubts that we had the right version of the Ten Commandments. He said, I actually heard about another alternative set of Ten Commandments, and maybe they're true. But you know what? The original record, it's not there, so we just don't know at this moment.
So recently I've seen a few prominent people on sort of our side spreading some equally ridiculous claims, people that I otherwise respect. And I'm thinking particularly of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, who have both claimed that Jefferson and Franklin in particular were atheists. And I frankly think that claim is every bit as dishonest and wrong as anything offered by David Barton or any of the other Christian nation apologists.
Yeah, I don't know where they get that from. I mean, perhaps Christopher Hitchens gets it from a Straussian, a Leo Straussian interpretation, where Leo Strauss is a famous political philosopher who argued that you had to read between the lines of what a philosopher was saying in order to really get to the truth, and he argues that Locke was probably a secret atheist, even though Locke and all of his textual writings claimed to believe in God and called himself a Christian. But from what I've seen Thomas Jefferson write both publicly and privately, he devoutly believed not only in God but Providence. Ditto for Ben Franklin.
Well, I think with Hitchens, you know, I've seen him challenged on this. Mm-hmm. And when challenged on it, in sort of typical fashion, he comes out mostly being snide.
Yeah.
In response, and one of the things, you know, he then sort of backs down to the position of, well, nobody can prove that he was.
Yes.
I just think it can be argued that he was, and quite frankly, I don't think it can even be argued.
No, I don't.
I mean,
so.
You look at these. The argument that I've heard made is that, well, it wasn't politically safe for him to come out as an atheist. He was a politician, but even after he left public office, even in private letters to people he had literally sworn to secrecy, as he did Benjamin Rush, for example. And said, you can never tell anyone about this. He still was very – in fact, in one of the letters, you know, he goes after Calvin. He was very anti-Calvinist. And one of his arguments against John Calvin's theology was that Calvin's theology was so absurd that it might lead people to atheism.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing. So it's not just that Jefferson was not an atheist. Jefferson was anti-atheist.
Yeah, if you look at Jefferson's private letters, it's clear that he believed in – a personal, benevolent God.
Right. He didn't believe in hell.
God.
Right. He didn't believe in hell. He didn't believe in sort of all of the mythology around that, but clearly believed in a benevolent interventionist God.
Yeah, he didn't
God.
Believe in the sort of the holy, wrathful God of the scriptures. He believed in a benign, benevolent God.
So I think we've nailed pretty well what their beliefs are, but of course they're really two distinct issues here. The first is what they believed about religion, and the second is what they believed about the relationship between religion and government. And while they all had similar beliefs about religion, I think those five key founding fathers, they had a pretty big divide when it comes to the separation of church and state. Talking just about those key founders, what did they think about the question of separation of church and state?
Well, from Jefferson and from Madison, I think it's pretty clear that they believed in the separation of church and state. They thought that government support of religion was bad for government, was bad for religion. Washington and Adams believed that government support for religion, for the Christian religion, wasn't necessarily a bad thing for either of them. Washington and Adams both probably supported some type of meaningful connection between government and religion, but Washington and Adams also believed in respecting the rights of conscience, the unalienable, free, and equal rights of conscience. Washington and Adams did not believe that a mild establishment of religion would violate the unalienable rights of conscience, whereas Jefferson and Madison did. Ben Franklin didn't write quite as much about the other four, but I think he's probably closer to Jefferson and Madison's side than Washington or Adams' side.
Yeah, one of the big splits between them is over the issue of sort of rhetorical support for religion.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington and Adams both issued many declarations of thanksgiving, days of prayer, proclamations of prayer and fasting, that sort of thing. Jefferson very famously refused to ever issue such things. And Madison, under enormous political pressure during the War of 1812, did issue one or two of them and then later said, I was wrong to do it. So we have Jefferson and Madison who thought that even a non-coercive, even if it's strictly, you know, advisory, and Washington and Adams were very careful to say, and very careful to make sure that those proclamations that they did issue were non-denominational, not even specifically Christian. They would use very sort of broad language, the supreme architect of the universe. They wanted it to be very sort of a general civic religion as opposed to a specific Christian
religion. I use the term generic providentialism.
Yeah, and I think that's what they did. Whereas Jefferson Adams said, listen, Jefferson and Madison said, even if it's advisory only, even if it's totally non-coercive, it's still something the government shouldn't be meddling in, period.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the big differences. The terms that I've always used for them is you have sort of the strict separationists, which are Jefferson and Madison, and Washington Adams would be sort of called accommodationists to some degree. And the argument that Adams in particular made several times was that this was an important prop for public virtue.
Yeah.
That it helped encourage people to be virtuous.
Well, that's what George Washington was also even more so all about.
Yeah, in his last
farewell address.
Yeah.
He thought that the people needed religion in order to be moral. I think that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison would probably agree to some extent.
They just didn't think the government should be the one encouraging.
They didn't think government should fund or promote religion because they felt that would probably be corrupting. But I think all of the key founding fathers thought that religion in general needed, or the public should be religious in general. That, you know, if we have self-government where it's not the government, a tyrannical government who's controlling you and forcing you what to do, how will free people sort of control themselves and be civil? Well, you do that by believing in religion, by believing in an overriding providence and future state of rewards and punishments. And, you know, when it came to Christianity, what they really valued about Christianity was Jesus' moral teachings. What they did not seem to value at all about Christianity was Jesus' claim as God, Jesus' claim as the only way to God, and Jesus' atonement. What they valued about Christianity was Jesus' moral teachings, because morality and civic virtue, that's what they thought religion could do for government. So it wasn't, you know, what can government do for religion necessarily, it was what was religion could do for government. And if you aren't evangelical or an Orthodox Christian, you really have to think to yourself, is that really the proper way I should understand my faith?
Well, I would only say that I don't think Jefferson really would have said that. Jefferson argued very strenuously in several letters that religion was not necessary to be moral. And
he listed, thought atheists could
yeah,
be
he said,
moral.
You know, listen, yeah. He looked at people like Condorcet and de Holbach and said these are men of, you know, unimpeachable public virtue, and yet they are atheists. And so I'm not sure that he would agree with that. I think the other three probably would more tend to. I think the argument that annoys me the most is the claim that the nation was founded on biblical or Christian principles. And my challenge to those who make that claim has always been, look, point to the provisions found in the Constitution and then point to analogs in the Bible or in Christian theology prior to that time. And such parallels, you know, are just virtually non-existent.
Yeah, well, the Bible is godless, as two authors from Cornell noted. And then the other side might note, well, the Bible was done in the date of the year of the Lord, which was the customary
The Constitution, you mean, not the Bible.
Sorry.
Yeah.
A little nervous here. Constitution was the customary way of stating the date.
Right.
That's
really reaching, I think. But in fact, I mean, we know what the sources that the founders turned to for the ideas that formed the basis of our Constitution, we know them quite well, don't we?
Yeah. When it came to the Constitution, they turned to, you know, John Locke. They turned to the Enlightenment. They turned to Greco-Roman principles. Thomas Jefferson, when he said in an 1825 letter to Richard Henry Lee, the four principles for the Declaration of Independence were Aristotle, Cicero, Sidney, and Locke. He didn't mention the Bible. The Federalist Papers do not cite the Bible for its principles. At the Constitutional Convention, the Bible is not cited for the principles of the Constitution. So the Bible really plays a small role in the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Federalist Papers and the Constitution.
Yeah, and Greg Fraser makes that point particularly about the Federalist Papers. You know, these were what, 85, I believe, essays.
Yeah.
Written by primarily by Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, And these were written to explain and defend the provisions of the new Constitution to the American people, to a predominantly Christian people. Certainly, if they could point to biblical justification for those principles, they would have used it.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They mentioned John Locke. They mentioned, you know, Montesquieu, the famous French philosopher. They mentioned Algernon Sidney. They mention Cicero and many Roman examples from the Roman and Greek democracies and so forth, never mentioned the Bible anywhere in there. Let's take a step forward. Let's apply some of what we now know about the views of these key founders to contemporary disputes, because people ask, I'm sure they ask you all the time as they ask me, why do you care what these people believed about religion? They've, you know, been dead for 200 years. Well, part of what the reason you care is because, as you were saying earlier, these arguments are used to justify contemporary positions on church-state positions. So given what we know about those key founders, how do you think they would respond, for example, to disputes over displays of the Ten Commandments on public property?
That's a good question. I don't think that George Washington or John Adams would have a problem.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I think that Jefferson and Madison would have a problem on the grounds that it violated the so-called separation of church and state, or in Madison's terminology, that government was taking cognizance over religion. I think that all four or five of the key founders would like what's on the Supreme Court frieze, where you see Moses and the Ten Commandments surrounded by a plethora of other secular and pagan lawgivers, because they thought that the truth with a capital T upon which they founded America wasn't just found within the Christian system, but was found within, you know, most, if not all, world systems, where man could use his keen reason to pick out where that truth was to be found in all of the different systems. And even someone like Noah Webster, who later on in his life did become an Orthodox Christian when he was in the late 18th century describing what the Constitution was all about, he said something along the lines of, you know, we consulted all of the sources of antiquity and we came out with a, quote, empire of reason. Now, I just paraphrased him, but his actual line that he used was, end quote, empire of reason, unquote.
And in fact, the irony of that is that now Noah Webster is quoted widely from after his conversion to Christianity.
Yeah.
Is quoted widely as you know, supporting the support for religion. And interesting, the point you just made is something I intended to ask you about earlier and forgot to put on my notes, which is that the other interesting thing about those key founding fathers was that they were all universalists.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked today about the UU Church, the Unitarian Universalist Church. Now, that didn't exist at the time.
No.
So they weren't capital U Unitarians or capital U Universalists, but they did believe that there was one God. They all believed that, you know, this is Unitarianism at its core. There is only one God. But they also believed that there were multiple paths to God, and that all the major religions were just sort of culturally specific interpretations of God and ways to talk about God. And in particular, you and I have both written about this. You know, when they wrote to the Indians, as they frequently did, they would always refer to God as the Great Spirit, as the Indians did, because to them there wasn't a difference.
No,
there was just one God, and that was it.
I've actually discussed this with a lot of other learned people, and the honest ones admit, yes, this dynamic is true. But then they say, well, the founders were not good theologians because, you know, these other religions, they're not worshiping the Christian God or the Judeo-Christian God. But they really did believe that most, if not all, world religions worship the same overriding providence. And that providence could be Allah to the Islams, Muslims. It could be Jehovah to the Jews. It could be God the Father to the Christians. It could be the Great Spirit to the Indians. And surprisingly, I've even seen John Adams writing in 1813 that Hindus and pagan Greeks worship the same God as Christians do, and that Zeus worship is the same thing as Christianity. And that kind of made me scratch my head that he actually believed that. But
yeah, and he actually used the term Christian extremely broadly.
Yes.
When he said Christian, he actually said this in one of his letters, all good people are Christians.
That's what the test was. That's the key.
Right.
Is that virtue is the key to religion. So if you were a good person, regardless of whether you consciously understood yourself to be a Christian, you were a Christian, and consequently men would be justified through their works and not their faith. Good people would receive heaven immediately upon death. Bad people would be temporarily punished and then eventually redeemed.
Yeah. Last question here. In light of the various positions taken by that key group of founders on a separation of church and state, what standard would you apply in deciding what is or is not a violation of the Establishment Clause? Would you favor the sort of coercion standard of Scalia or the endorsement test of Justice O'Connor?
That's a great test. That's a great question.
You have 30 seconds, by the way.
I would go for an equality standard. I think the equality standard is the closest thing to the Founding Fathers. I have a number of friends who argue quite convincingly that the separation doctrine is not sound from an originalist perspective and that it should be overruled and the Establishment Clause should not be incorporated against the state and local governments. And I respond to them, if that's true, then look for equality and equal protection to rise out of the ashes of the Establishment Clause. And that would mean non-discrimination on religious grounds. School vouchers would be okay as long as they're done on secular, non-discriminatory grounds. But something like under God in the Constitution might not be, or in public life might not be okay, because that violates the equal rights of atheists and polytheists.
That's a really interesting argument, and I wish we had more time to get into that now. But I do think that equality is a big part of what these people believed in there, that it was equal access to the public square.
Yes.
Was a big consideration for those men, and the notion that the government simply should stay out of, because like I said, even with Washington and Adams, although they issued those days of proclamation and prayer and so forth, they were very generic. They certainly would not have wanted to distinguish even Christians from non-Christians. And remember that in those days, non-believers were virtually unheard of.
Yes.
There were a few in France. And that was about it. So to them, to even consider atheists was probably, you know, just not done because there were hardly any of them around.
Actually, one quotation from Washington and one quotation from Adams talking about atheists, and they both say that they don't believe government should harm atheists.
Sure. Would never have favored anything coercive.
Yeah, never. So. Never do anything coercive towards atheists. I think both Washington and John Adams believe that all of us had equal rights regarding religion, and they just believe that we could have a mild establishment, we could have government funding and support of religion without violating equal rights. I don't think Jefferson or Madison believed that we could.
And I think with today's sort of more pluralist society, where now we do have non-believers and we really do have Jews and Muslims and Hindus and so forth,
yeah, we do,
as significant parts of the body politic, I think, you know, if you're going to – you have sort of have two originalist possibilities here. I think clearly the Madison-Jefferson version is better under current circumstances, you know, that we should pick that for that reason.
I would say when in doubt, you know, don't discriminate. When in doubt, treat people as equals. If something violates the conscience of an atheist or a polytheist, you know, don't go for it. And so I would be sympathetic to – you know, Michael Newdow's claim about under God. You know, personally, it doesn't bother me, but if it really does bother atheists or polytheists, then if it treats them as unequal citizens, I don't think we should say under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm not sure if the founders exactly would have seen it that way, but I think it is an extension of their principles.
Yeah, I think it is too, and I that's a really interesting perspective. We'll have to bring you back on and talk about that in more detail at some point. John, thanks very, very much for being on the show.
All right, it was my pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, bye.
I want to thank my guests, Chase Martin and John Rowe, for being with us. Join us again next week on Declaring Independence here on WPR. I do want to mention one more thing, which is the Reasonable Doubts podcast, which is put together by my producer, Jeremy Behan, with a couple of other people. Really good material. And if you listen to my show and you like my show, I think you really like that one as well. You can get that at www.doubtcast.org. And you can download the podcast from that show every week as well.
Declaring Independence is a production of WPRR Reality Radio. Ed Brayton is a fellow of the Center for Independent Media, but views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Center for Independent Media or its contributors. Technical assistance provided by Jeremy Behan and David Fletcher. To share this program with a friend or catch up on previous episodes, check out the Declaring Independence podcast, available at publicrealityradio.org.